Good morning. This is session number 316, Gays in the Mormon Universe. I'd like to ask you, especially since this is the first session in the morning, to please turn off your cell phones and paging devices and anything else that would make noise. We're happy to welcome this morning our two presenters, Buckley Jepson and Jeffrey Nielsen. Buckley works as a writer and business process consultant in Washington, D.C. He was born in Utah but grew up in Southern California. He served a mission in South America and then earned a B.A. and M.A. from California State University, Long Beach. Buckley and Mike Kessler were married when some Canadian provinces began granting marriage licenses, August 27, 2004. Buckley has a daughter and a new granddaughter who is here. With her, and the granddaughter has three grandfathers, and he says has no hope of growing up normally. Jeffrey Nielsen is a philosopher educated at Weber State University and Boston College. At Boston College, Jeff was a teaching fellow where he taught courses in logic and critical thinking, the history and philosophy of art and science, as well as in epistemology. He has also taught in the philosophy department at Brigham Young University, where he taught courses in ethics and leadership, reasoning and writing, an introduction to and history of philosophy, as well as in the history and development of science. Jeff is also the author of a new book, The Myth of Leadership, Creating Leaderless Organizations, which offers a new paradigm in organizational management to replace the traditional rank-based leadership model. BYU refused to review his adjunct teaching contract in June after he penned an op-ed piece for the Salt Lake Tribune that was critical of the LDS Church's position on same-sex marriage. And I have to say, the only thing I feel bad about your letter is that I didn't write it. As well as its failure to be more open and honest about the church's history. He is married with four children. Buckley.
Thank you. I'd like to thank Sunstone for inviting us, having us here, and for all of you for getting out of bed this morning, which is no small task, I know, from my own experience this morning. What we'd like to do today is look at some of the trends in the United States and around the world in terms of gay rights, look at the churches, reaction to that and the members' reactions individually and as a group. Jeff and I will talk about our own personal experiences in this arena and look ahead a bit at how the church and its gay members may be able to live together and prosper. One note that I wanted to say in getting started here is the current bellwether for measuring how equal rights is marriage equality. That seems to be the one thing that that the organizations that are working for equality of gays and lesbians seem to work the hardest for, and those who are opponents seem to work the hardest against. So how that battle plays out and what happens as a result tends to show how things are going. So we'll refer to that probably a little bit more today than you would normally hear. In the United States, the current status is, very quickly, sodomy laws have been universally struck down by the Supreme Court a year or so ago. Half the states have laws that define marriage as an institution between one man and one woman to protect their citizens from having to abide by any by the laws of any other state that might threaten their views. Some states that isn't enough, and so they've passed constitutional amendments, some of them rather draconian. There's one state, Massachusetts, that has legalized marriage, and there's one state, Vermont, which has civil unions that afford some of the protections of marriage. And a few other states are moving that direction. Probably most notably Connecticut right now. I know there's some efforts in California and also in New Jersey and some other places. Many states, local jurisdictions, companies have prohibitions in their laws or in their company policies against harassing people because of their sexual orientation, just like harassing people because of their age or religion or sex. Some states have hate crimes legislation. There is no federal hate crimes legislation, and that protects sexual orientation. I don't believe Utah has a hate crimes legislation that prohibits that. The country is split about equally on the question of marriage equality, with the majority favoring granting equal rights, if not outright supporting marriage. The Family Marriage Amendment failed again this year, as it does the last few election years, when it's brought up, I think, in sort of a cynical attempt to create a wedge issue. And it's always unsuccessful, ultimately, but they know it's going to be unsuccessful going in, and it's just to provide a litmus test, it seems. Internationally, the international community seems to be going in the exact opposite direction. The movement is toward marriage equality. There are five countries where equality is extended to everyone. The first one was Belgium, then the Netherlands. Canada has it, started with a few provinces, and now is extended over the entire country. Spain now has same-sex marriage, as does South Africa. There are a number of other countries that have the equivalent of civil unions, including the UK and some Scandinavian countries. The only ones other than the United States that have actually gone the other direction and put pressure on equal rights are, the United States, of course, and then several Muslim countries who have strengthened their stance against homosexuals. A year ago, in August of last year, there were two teenagers who were hanged in Iran for perceived homosexual activity, two teenage boys. But other than that, no other countries other than the United States have actually made moves to go backward. In the church, the way I like to look at it is to see what's going on what went on in the past and what's going on in the present. And then we'll try to sort of look at what might happen in the future. Looking at several key indicators, in the past, just being gay was inherently evil and resulted in instant excommunication. Presently, being gay isn't evil. Acting gay is the transgression. In the past, being gay was perceived as being all about perversion. It was all about sex. Gays were equated with pedophilia, necrophilia, bestiality, transgender behavior, all kinds of other deviancies. A typical church court, which is what it was called then, included detailed questions about really intimate sexual practices, because that's what their focus was. It was very common for them the high council to ask things like, in your relationship, who's the man and who's the woman, and all kinds of really bizarre questions. Nowadays it's different. The word perversion isn't used by general authorities, but of course their focus is still entirely on the sexual acts, which is reflective of so many things in the church where there's problems. In the past, homosexual was a noun. Presently, the church is trying to rewrite the language and reframe it. And as we saw in the last conference, there are no homosexuals. Homosexual is now an adjective in their mind. And it's homosexual tendencies. People suffer from same-sex attraction. And like so many obedience-centered organizations, the church tries to control the language and the terms to meet their own needs. And they do that through church publications and speeches and other things. in the past, they used to say to, say, a man who went in and talked to his bishop, they would say, marry a good woman, it'll all go away. Presently, they're very careful about saying, don't marry a good woman, because it's not going to go away. Instead, they say, learn to live with your affliction. It's like being an alcoholic. Just learn to deal with it. In the past, because it was a cure, or because it was a choice, there was always a cure. Pray, fast, study, work, and some extreme examples in the past. There was aversion therapy, you know, pornographic aversion therapy, electrodes to the genitals, and all kinds of other things to try and help you along in your attempt to be cured. Presently, the church recognizes that it may not actually be a choice after all, and there are no church-sanctioned aversion therapies going on. There are support groups like Affirmation, I'm sorry, Evergreen, which is helped supported by the church, and they do things like baseball therapy, saying that, you know, we didn't spend enough time bonding with male figures in our lives, which is sort of an insult to those of us who have great relationships with our fathers, but there's a lot of that. Get together, play baseball together, slap each other on the back, and you'll eventually you won't have these feelings anymore. So that's the sort of the lay of the land right now, as at least as I see it. And I'd like to take a little bit of time now to talk about our personal stories, which in both cases involve confronting the church on various levels. In my case, on a very personal local level. As we know, politics is local everywhere. And in the case of Jeff's, on a less than local level. Both cases ended up being widely covered by the media and tend to be, continue to be, because they are examples in their own ways of how this issue is treated. In my case, I live in Washington, D.C., and I'm married to a really great guy who I met about almost, 9 years ago. And as soon as marriage was allowed in Canada, in a couple of provinces, we traveled to Toronto, which was the closest province that allowed us to get married. Went through all the paperwork and everything ahead of time, and we're married just 2 years ago this month. I've attended my inner city ward in Washington, D.C. since 1997 and have never had any problems with any of my church leadership until late last fall, when a new bishop took it upon himself to cleanse the ward. He was a bishop that was brought in from outside our ward boundaries. Sometimes, you know, in the inner city, we don't really know how to do things right. And it has to be someone from the burbs that tells us how to do things right. It's a very diverse ward, a wonderful ward. A lot of Africans. We have a Sunday school class that's taught in French because of all the West Africans. And people from all over the world. Our eldest quorum president is from the Ukraine. And I'm sorry, the high priest group leader is from the Ukraine. And there are a lot of other people. One of the members of the bishopric is from Africa. And our one missionary who is out from the ward in the field is working in the south, but he's originally from Nigeria, and his family's in the ward. During the time that I've been in the stake president and the high council, which I know about half of them personally, they've always known and actually didn't care, it didn't seem. But as soon as the bishop brought it up and started making it an issue, then the stake president felt it was his obligation to start talking to me about it. Late last fall, he gave me the choice of resigning my membership or facing a disciplinary council. We had several conversations on the subject with the stake president. Interestingly, none of them mentioned God anywhere. None of them mentioned Jesus. None of them mentioned spirituality, conscience, the nature of the church, or the family. None of these subjects, no matter how hard I tried, would ever surface in these conversations. The conversations were all about duty, about his responsibility, and ultimately, and it was about, of course, following the brethren, his moral duty. In other words, it wasn't about me at all, it was all about him. And I found that to be, of course, really problematic. I felt, as I've said several times, that I was on an edge of a cliff, and he'd said, either jump on your own or we'll push you. And I mean, I spent 57 years in the church at that point, and I was not about to jump. Jumping would be saying to my family, my daughter who's here, and her wonderful husband and perfect grandchild, and my husband and friends and others, and the rest of my family, that all that, I didn't believe in all that. All the service I did in bishoprics and as a missionary and other things didn't have any meaning after all. Just to avoid all the hassle, I would be perfectly happy to just chuck it all. And that wasn't right. And so as a matter of conscience, I said, you're going to have to deal with this on your own. I'm not going to help you out. It's my firm responsibility that as a leader in the church, you take responsibility for your actions, and you should be accountable for them and willingly be accountable for them. As the church should not be worried about whether people say bad things or not. If they have the truth, they have the truth. There's nothing to be embarrassed about. You know, speak your truth and let things be the way they are. At this time, I started to get kind of worried, so I cast out a net to find out if I was the first married LDS guy who was coming under pressure. And I checked with Affirmation, Gay and Lesbian Mormons, and they knew of no one. I checked with the Mormon Alliance, who does a wonderful job of chronicling and documenting cases of ecclesiastical abuse and that sort of thing. They knew of no existing case at that time. So in my casting about, it became known what was going on, and the reporters and others started to check in with me. I talked to the LDS Safe Space Coalition, which is a group actually based out in Washington, D.C., who sends hundreds of flowers at conference times to remind the members and the general authorities about the need to provide a safe space for its gay and lesbian and transgendered members. So eventually the reporter started calling, and I didn't grant any interviews. I started building my own case because I expected I would have to face a court. I did meet with a group of concerned and interested friends and others and allies and straight allies who were also very concerned that of the precedent that might be set. I talked to the state president about it, and I said, you know, all I want is for this to go away. That's all I've ever asked for. I just want to worship in peace with my tribe every Sunday. I'm not asking for a temple marriage. I'm not asking to be blessed. I'm not asking for anything other than simply be left alone. And he was unwilling to go that route. He kept asking me why I wanted to destroy the church and why I wanted to hurt the church. I explained so many times that was not my intention, that this was not my battle. I had not started it. But eventually, I did, when I realized I was facing an imminent call, I did grant an interview to Jennifer Dobner of Associated Press, who followed up on the sources, talked to the state president, talked to the church, talked to others. And despite being summarily sort of dismissed by the state president and treated sort of poorly, she still stuck with it and wrote a responsible article for the Associated Press that hit the wire in mid-March, and the letters and calls started pouring in right away and continue to do so today. The irony is that to pressure the state president into leaving me alone so I could practice my religion quietly and in peace, in a peaceful place, I had to go public, which is the last thing I would prefer to have done. I wanted to remain under the radar. Instead, Mike and I ended up being the poster boys, which we did not ask for. Also, the biggest irony probably is the reason that we went through all this and continue to go through it is all about family. It's about my daughter and my granddaughter and my son-in-law and our in-laws and my family, Mike's family, and all of our friends and others. That was my whole reasoning behind it. And yet, when it comes down to it, other than my immediate supportive family here, some of my extended family, my siblings and others, some of them have been less than happy about me being in the public eye. So to have to go public to defend it is difficult, and to suffer problems with family because you're trying to defend your family is another irony that is very difficult. The status of the case right now, several people have asked. The bishop, who usually called for what, about 5 years, at least in our area, within about a month after this, was summarily called on a mission to go to Mexico, and the stake president got very quiet. 6 months ago, if you were to Google his name, you would come up with all kinds of important information about him being present CEO of a major international company, about his $14 million salary last year, about the many boards that he sits on of other organizations, and that sort of thing, being a captain of industry. There is some sort of evil glee I get now in Googling his name, and the first thing you get are 6 pages about me. And knowing him, that's probably the ultimate insult for somebody who is absolutely obsessed with control. And he's learning that even on the internet, it's not about him, it's about me. The next salvo, I think, for gay Mormons came, and their families, came clothed in a letter from Jeff Nielsen. A letter from Jeff Nielsen in response to one that was written by the church and sent out to bishops. And that's basically where Jeff's story begins, and I think you should tell us about it.
Baseball therapy, that doesn't sound that bad. Better than aversion therapy. Though you'll notice they chose a non-contact sport, but that's... Buckley called and asked if I would join him on this panel, and I thank him for asking me, and he wanted me to talk about, well, the first question, we kind of were going to do a little dialogue back and forth after I talked for a few minutes on some questions we have for each other. But he asked me why I wrote this opinion piece. And I guess the short answer is Les Mis. Do you all know the musical Les Mis? Yeah. The week that I was, before the letter came out, and as I was writing it, I kept listening to Les Mis over and over and over and over again. This is the great anthem to the crisis of conscience and the great ideals of liberty and equality and justice. So I was listening to this CD over, the same two songs as well, over and over, I'll let you guess which they were, over and over again. It got so bad that my wife actually banned the music from our home and hid the CD. I am still trying to find where she hid it. I did find her chocolate stash, though, so I haven't told her that. So now I also have an unending supply of chocolate, and I will still find that CD somewhere. Whenever I talk about this, I'd like to begin by quoting one of my favorite historians, Theodore Zeldin, who once in one of his books wrote that fear is nearly always more powerful than our desire for freedom. That statement right there explains so much of human history. Fear is nearly always more powerful than our desire for freedom. And he goes on to say, for that reason, society for most people, and we could even add religion for most people, society for most people has been merely a protection racket where they trade in their freedom for some ultimately illusion of material or emotional or spiritual security. And I was thinking about that idea of how fear so often stops us from doing what really is the right thing. Back in March or April, I was preparing to do some writing on democracy, and I was teaching at BYU and thinking about, again, those great ideals of liberty and equality and justice. And I always have my, I won't have you do this, but I always have my class, when we talked about justice, whenever I said the word justice, they had to echo back justice. You know, that it was such an important concept. As I was studying these ideas, I looked a bit at the civil rights movement. I watched a couple of documentaries on the civil rights movement. And it started me thinking, I mean, I was born in 61, so I was just a young child during the civil rights movement. And I began to think about the church's, what I believe to be, not doctrinal or theological, but their subtly racist view of people of color. And back in the 60s and 70s, the exclusion, of course, of people of color or blacks from the priesthood. And I was thinking about that, and I asked myself, I said, if I had been an adult, would I have had the courage to say something publicly about that, to challenge that idea that skin color is somehow a reflection of spiritual unworthiness? And I hypothetically wondered if I would have done that. Would I have put my family in jeopardy to say something against something that I think is unjust and immoral? And then I thought about the women's movement for equality in the early 70s, and I wondered if I had been an adult, would I have had the integrity to stand up and speak for the equality and the justice of equal rights for women? So this was all hypothetical. And then, of course, on May, you have the date here, May 28th, when the letter was read in our congregations asking the members, at least the way I interpreted it, there was the recommendation that we involve ourselves politically to have our senators endorse or vote for an amendment that would ultimately prohibit same-sex couples from marrying. That hypothetical reflection I had became a concrete reality at that point. And I had to ask myself, sitting there in sacrament meeting, would I now, with my family around me, would I have the courage to say something about what I thought was politically unjust and ethically immoral? And that was a position I was in, so I went home from sacrament. I think I might have skipped high priest quorum, I don't remember. Don't tell anybody if I did that I said that. I don't want to get in any more trouble. But I went home and I began to write the piece. And I wanted to kind of, you know, distinguish and make some distinctions here. I did not want to come across as challenging the historicity of any of the religious claims of the church. That might be heresy and legitimate grounds for excommunication. I did not want to challenge theologically the right of the brethren to determine church doctrine or policy. That would be apostasy. But I did think that as a member of the church, I had every right, in fact, every obligation to address what was a moral concern, a moral issue about a social practice of excluding same-sex couples and gays and lesbians from full faith and fellowship in the church. I saw that not as a religious or a theological, but a moral issue. And it was also political, because I found, as that letter was read, I found that I was engaged not only as a member of the church at that point, but I was also engaged as a citizen of the United States of America to endorse a law that I thought would be immoral and unjust. So those were sort of the reasons that I sat down to write that piece, again, hoping to be clear that this was a political issue and a moral issue. Now, of course, BYU interpreted this as speaking against the brethren, and apparently, you know, you never read the fine print of contracts when you, at least I don't, but when you sign on to teach at BYU, you do agree not to challenge the obviously the first presidency in the Quorum of the Twelve not publicly, but you don't challenge them. And I always took that seriously, so in the BYU classroom, I would never violate that stewardship and publicly challenge. But I saw this as a public issue, as a public venue, and not something that would violate my BYU contract. Of course, they interpret it differently. I have no hard feelings about that. I have only the utmost respect and gratitude to BYU, and I admire the faculty and the students there immensely. So I wrote the piece. Now, Buckley wanted me to say a bit about the fallout, and I did receive a bunch of emails. It's kind of interesting. They came in three waves. The first wave came from ex-Mormons who were writing to say that they had experienced what I talked about, namely the fact that you can find out more real history of the church online in 30 minutes than you can in a lifetime studying church-approved materials. They wrote me to tell me that that had happened to them, that they discovered certain things that were never taught in institute or Sunday school, and that made them feel like they had been lied to all their life. And when they shared that with their spouse couldn't deal with it. And it became an issue. Either you shut up and suppress your doubts, your questions, or our marriage is over. And a lot of people wrote me about that. So that was the first wave of emails coming from ex-Mormons who'd experienced the harm and the pain that comes from the church not being open and transparent with its history. The second wave of emails came from gays and lesbians who were suffering harm because of the church exclusive social practices and ideas. And the third wave came from active members of the church, and this wave still continues, active members of the church who were writing to let me know that they too were troubled by this letter. They too were troubled by the church's position on same-sex attraction and offering support. And I came to realize through this experience that there are a lot of committed, good Latter-day Saints who are working quietly and patiently to change the opinion in the church on this issue of same-sex attraction. Some of them are here today who I have the utmost respect and admiration for. In any case, we want to get into some more detail here, so I want to begin by asking Buckley, do you still want to talk about this? That's kind of the background of where I'm coming from. And now, you kind of already addressed this, Buckley, but the question was, what is the reaction of ordinary members in your family when this came about? Okay. You want to say a few things?
Just a couple of other things. I did mention that I had some issues with my family. In the ward and stake, actually, it's been great. I have had no problems with anyone. The wards that I previously belonged to with straight couples, we still go out to dinner with them. Mike and I, we go to plays and things and have great relationships with them. When we had a wedding reception, a little casual wedding reception, a number of couples from the ward came, as well as people from our work and our friends, and so, including, of course, Olivia and Scott, my daughter and her husband. And so, in general, it's been a very good, and that gives me a lot of hope for the future. And the other thing that has come out of all this is people have begun to talk about it to us, and they've been coming to the same realization that we always knew, of course, which was, like every other marriage is not about sex. Marriage is about commitment. Marriage is about giving your life to somebody else and being there to take care of them in sickness and in health, which for two guys can be obnoxious because men are not really good sick people, as you know. And so that takes an extra challenge. But otherwise, that's what marriage is about. And it's about the same thing for all of us. And it was great to have people come up to us and express that realization, like, gee, you're just normal people. And it's great to be normal. I'm interested, Jeff, also about how you had your family react and the people in your ward and others reacted. And also, you talked about it as being a moral issue, and I also see it as a civil rights issue, and I kind of wanted to get your feelings on those thoughts.
I'll talk about the civil rights issue. I'm a pretty private person, believe it or not. And I don't like.
Tried.
Yeah, you tried. You tried. And here's where the professor in me might come out. But I would define civil rights as basic human liberties, that we believe in our political community, everyone should have an equal privilege to enjoy. Now, civil rights would be distinguished from human rights or natural rights because civil rights then have the force of law or constitutional authority that defines the duty that the government has to respect these basic liberties. And the government is not, it's unjust if the government makes some arbitrary distinction to exclude an entire class of people from enjoying those same equal privileges. And that's what I think happens with this exclusion of same-sex couples from marriage. That when you come to look at same-sex attraction and see it as biologic and natural, you realize that to exclude same-sex couples from the covenant of marriage is an arbitrary distinction that is unjust and should be changed. Now, I don't want to just leave it there as a civil rights issue because I've said that it's kind of funny. People always ask me if I'm gay. I'm not gay. No, there's nothing wrong with that. No, that's that old Seinfeld thing. Sorry, I'm just trying to lighten the mood here. And I didn't really have, there was no gay members of my family or no gay acquaintances, but since June 4th, as you can imagine, I've met many, many gays and lesbians, and I have been struck by their moral decency and their basic human goodness. And it's become unconscionable to me, getting to know these people, that we allow anyone to characterize them as unnatural or as an abomination. That just seems to me completely unconscionable to do that once you get to know these as individuals. I've also come to know same-sex couples, and what I've realized is, because I too believe that strong marriage and families are important for the stability and well-being and vitality of our society, and I have become convinced that our society would be so greatly enhanced and strengthened by allowing same-sex couples into the marriage covenant that we can't even imagine the goodness that would come from that. So I don't want to leave it as a civil rights issue, but it's also a social benefit issue, that how beneficial it would be to allow these committed same-sex couples into the covenant of marriage. So that would be my response there, Buck. Let me just ask you, how do you feel your civil rights might have been restricted by the events that you've experienced?
I should say that some of my best friends are straight, too.
And there's nothing wrong with that.
It's interesting because we live in a place that is the exact opposite of Provo, for example, where it's the most liberal, most democratic, democratic politically, jurisdiction in the entire country. It votes more heavily for Democrats than Utah even votes for Republicans. In fact, the Republicans don't even bother campaigning there, and the big election for mayor there is the campaign for the Democratic nomination, because it's just assumed that that person will become the next mayor. So we live in a place where some of the things that gay couples face here, we don't face to the same extent. We have no problem holding hands on the street, for example. That isn't an issue in Washington, D.C. When we part at the bus stop in the morning on our way to work on separate buses, we have no problem giving each other a kiss goodbye in the morning. So the sort of the social things aren't nearly as big a deal as they would be if we lived in Salt Lake City or Provo. But what that does is it focuses on the things that you're talking about, I think, Jeff, which is some of the civil rights things. All things we have to go to if one of us is in the hospital, for example. You can't just go in the operating room, the emergency room, unless you are married. Since our marriage is not recognized, even though we went to the trouble of going there, we don't have that benefit. There are over 1,000 other benefits, and we feel them every single day, from the tax laws to the fact that no matter what we do, our wills can be challenged. Someone, if I were to die, my family, if they were so inclined, which they're not, thank goodness, could move in, take all the furniture, and kick him out. A lot of things like that that you take for granted as a married couple, inheritance rights, the right of all those 1,000 other rights are compromised. So, yeah, it no matter what, you're a second-class citizen as a married couple. And that's always always in our mind. It's always back there, even though we try and ignore it. We'd like to open it up for questions because we only have about 15 minutes here. But before we do that, I wanted to just mention and give a thanks to those people who are here and who are not here, who are so involved in the struggle and the fight for rights for gays and lesbians in the church, and they range from the people who are like Affirmation, who are composed of gay and lesbian members, through those who provide the most support, which are our straight allies, and there are individuals like Jeff, like Ron Scow, like Bill Bradshaw at BYU, the Bob and Lanny Graves out where we are, Gary and Millie Watts of Family Fellowship, Ron Scow, Robert Reese, Mary Beth Raines, all these people who over the years have made it very important to try and fight for equality. People like the Safe Space, LDS Safe Space Coalition, the Mormon Alliance, and so many others, all the bloggers, have made a huge difference as things happen. So we're very grateful for all that you do. It means a lot. You do a lot of things that we can't do for ourselves, and we're quite grateful for that. Questions. Anyone have any questions you'd like to ask any of us? And would you please come up to the microphone to do that?
I get to run this part. Okay. And I'm going to take my prerogative as having at having the microphone to make a comment. I'm a lawyer, and I've given a good deal of thought to issues surrounding gay marriage. And the church, and more broadly, the religious right, has framed gay marriage as a threat to heterosexual marriage. And as far as I can tell, we heterosexuals don't need gay people to mess up our marriages. We've done very well all by ourselves. And if I were to make a list of threats to heterosexual marriages, gay marriage isn't even on the chart. Now, one of the ironies that I see in this struggle over gay marriage is that because there is this gut opposition to gay marriage from certain quarters, it's really not feasible in the United States to legislatively enact gay marriage. So what states are doing all across the country where there is sympathy toward gay couples is, instead of passing allowing gays to marry, they're passing domestic partnership laws. When they pass domestic partnership laws, I think they do create a grave danger to marriage, because when they do it, they don't just enable gay people to marry, but they typically create, I mean, to have a domestic partnership, but they typically create a domestic partnership that heterosexuals can also enter into, so that people who are living together but who have not married can have the same kind of rights that a gay couple could have where they're prohibited from marriage. The way this undermines marriage is that it creates this halfway step between being not married and being married that gives some of the rights of marriage to heterosexual couples who could marry but who choose not to. Now that, to me, I think, is a significant threat to creating the kinds of long-term stable relationships that marriage is designed to create. So the irony I see in the opposition to gay marriage is that it's driving a legal system that gives people an alternative to marriage that the very people who oppose gay marriage would also oppose. And if they would instead just allow gays to marry, then it puts gays on the same footing as everybody else on the same footing as heterosexual couples, without giving heterosexual couples an out that is something less than marriage. Now, let's see. I think Michael.
I had a question. Well, first I had a comment. When I heard the letter read over the pulpit, the first thing I thought was that there's probably, you know, at least one homosexual in the room right now that just heard their church and their, you know, who they've devoted their lives to, just publicly ask everybody in their ward to continue alienating them more and condemning their beliefs. And what I thought was that, what I think that the church was trying to use that is sort of to use the trying to get everybody to, you know, make an amendment and pass a law illegalizing gay marriage, and thought they were trying to maybe get some more leverage against gay people, like I feel they've done with modern polygamy. I've heard the argument, well, polygamists, they're not law, it's illegal, they're not law-abiding citizens, how can they be good people? And I mean, that's what I think maybe is that in doing that, they were trying to say, well, these people are sinners and they're criminals, you know, don't talk to them, alienate them. But I guess my question is what do you think about that? And how is it, I guess, hurt, what's the damage? How's it shaken your beliefs? Or if it has, what has it done to your faith in the LDS Church?
Well, I think that you're right. The primary arguments against same-sex marriage, I think, do come from certain religious assumptions that homosexuality is immoral, that it's sinful. I've never believed that, and I don't accept that it is, that you should apply the same standards to same-sex attraction that you apply to heterosexual attraction. The committed, loving relationship is what we should be seeking for, and not condemning it out of hand. The key part of your question was what does this do to my faith when my leaders, the leaders of my church, say something that I disagree with? And I think in my mind, my faith is such that as a philosopher, I don't believe that unexamined belief is really faith. It's superstition, and we must constantly challenge unquestioned faith. And faith has room for doubts. Faith has room for disagreements. Faith has room for questions, all based on the trust that we have in one another. So I don't, in my mind, my faith doesn't require that everybody agrees with me or that my point of view exactly coincide with that of my church leaders. I appreciate the fact that my faith has room for those doubts and those disagreements. So I guess that's how I would sort of respond to that. Not very well, but it's a response. So.
Hi. I'll preface my comments by saying that I'm a queer kid as well. So, but I believe that when Boyd K. Packer says that the three great enemies of the church are gay people, feminists, and intellectuals, I believe he's right. Okay, I absolutely believe he is correct in saying that, because it seems to me that the root of this isn't morality. The root of this is sustaining patriarchy. All right. So, fundamentally, if you have two men or two women who can enter into a loving partnership devoid of that gendered hierarchy, that is a threat. And that fundamentally is why the LDS Church and the evangelicals and the GOP, that is why they hate us. So, systemically, this is the issue. Mormon patriarchy is built upon a male domination system. where women are subordinate. This is why polygamy is okay, but gay marriage is not okay. So how do you think gay marriage and gay equality really would, and for that matter, let's say women's equality, okay? How do you think this really could disrupt patriarchy, and could that maybe be a good thing?
I can hand the hard ones.
Yeah. As of 9:35 this morning, I was still a member of the church. What now? I don't know what you're... That's a... Sorry, my humor might be off. There are two sort of moral principles I try to lead my life by, not very well, because we're all imperfect. One that this speaks to is this basic idea that every one of us, regardless of our position or place in an organization or society, each one of us has an equal privilege to speak, and each one of us share an equal and reciprocal obligation to listen. Now that basic principle, I think, does disrupt patriarchy, or this idea that we have in our rank-based mentality that only those at the top, and they tend to be white males, only those at the top have the privilege to speak, and everyone else has the obligation to listen and obey. Now, I fundamentally challenge that. I think scripturally we have a basis to challenge that rank-based patriarchy. And all of us are engaged in this. I think you're right to say that as long as we press this idea of equal privilege to speak and equal and reciprocal obligation to listen, patriarchy will evaporate. But it won't happen overnight, and we have to be engaged in such a way that we don't offend or alienate. And maybe this, you might not agree with me here, but I fundamentally believe that we are engaged. The choice before us is not whether we're going to be engaged or not, but how we're going to be engaged. Are we going to be engaged with reason and compassion? Or are we going to be engaged with hostility, animosity, and hatred? I think that will determine the outcome. So I think we need to take this passion that we have against patriarchy, Troy, and we have to find a way to express it in a way that is dripping with reason, dripping with compassion, dripping with respect for even for those who don't agree with us. But nevertheless, it's present. So that's how I would respond.
I'm just gonna add one quick thing to that. I think we're both on the same wavelength on that. We have both chosen to stay and fight from within the church, and that's not an easy thing to do. It's certainly not easy for gay people who face it every time they go to church. And most gay people have really been abused and beaten up and damaged, and they have a very difficult time staying in the church and in any way. And I feel like, for me personally, I have to be there, I have to be engaged, I have to do it with compassion and with reason, or not only is it damaging to the cause, it's damaging to me personally. So that's a choice that I make too.
To preface my question, I want to share a few things. My name is Mike Green. I'm the National Chair for Gamma Fights, Gay Mormon Fathers. In early May, I was contacted by Nightline to where they wanted to do a story on the Gamma Fight organization. I spent about 6 to 8 hours with the producers of Nightline, and as a result, they came to Salt Lake City and in the middle of May attended a family fellowship meeting where Bill Bradshaw was speaking and did filming. We coordinated quite a few people for those who saw that effort that was actually shown on June 7th. I felt that it gave a really good representation of our story. Unfortunately, the church posted their response on their website to that production. Our stories, I didn't feel like that our stories were validated with the pain and suffering that had gone on, and at first that made me angry because what they came out and said, that none of this is true, we love our gay and lesbian children. And so as I thought more about that, I realized that, well, here's an opportunity for us to capitalize on what they are saying. And today I've put together with my partner Scott, and I've put together a list of recent quotes from church leaders that are pretty good. And yeah, they're not in this direction where we've been talking today as far as gay marriage, but the baby steps that are necessary to help church members in particular coming across from the pulpit of the conference center, I think can be helpful for being able to communicate to members at the local level. I think there is a new trend with gays and lesbians who are attending church, and as more and more straight people take issue with this and come to terms with this because they have gay friends or gay family members, as we begin to hear more of this message over the pulpit that our churches at the that the leaders at the highest level are actually saying, then I think that we can possibly start making impact at the local level. And so I'd like to hear your comments on some of the things that church leaders can be, that we can be saying at the local level in our wards.
I just want to say that we need to keep this brief because our time actually is up, but we got a little bit of a late start, and maybe we can just take 1 or 2 minutes over. So would either of you like to respond?
I do think there is movement within the church. I hope there's more, and certainly by these, I think it's great that you're distributing these, and I hope they can become more widely distributed because there certainly is a movement in that direction. After we're through here, if there's anyone who'd like to come up and speak with us, of course, we're happy to answer your questions.
If the two of you who are in line have something real brief to say, we can go ahead.
I do. I actually have a question.
Thank you. Okay.
No, I don't have a speech prepared. My question is for Jeff. Shortly after you wrote your letter, you were interviewed on the Doug Fabrizio show, and you seemed very, very shell-shocked, understandably. But you said several times you weren't sure if you should have even have written the letter or not. And I'm curious, now that the dust has settled, How you feel about it?
I heard that interview. You came across as so incredibly nice.
Yeah, shell shock. Let's retract that from the record.
Obviously, I'm projecting.
Yes, and I'm a little worried because you're drawing cartoons of us as well. So am I in a bunker? No, I'm joking. Yeah, some people have asked me about that, and I want to be very clear that I have no regrets about writing the letter. What I was trying to express on Doug's show was this moral dilemma. What do you do when your conscience puts you in direct conflict with your church authorities and with the welfare of your family? That's what I was trying to express. I think it was an important point to bring out, that there are times in our lives where our conscience will bring us in conflict with authority figures, and by speaking our conscience, we do affect the welfare of our family. And I was trying to bring out that dilemma, hoping that people would draw the inference that there was something immoral in any context where some organization requires members to fall into that quandary. So that's what I was trying to express, but obviously not very articulately. So now you know the rest of the story. Okay, thanks.
Thank you very much for a really good session.